A Podcast One production.
This is The Five of My Life with me, Nigel Marsh. The series where I talk to notable people about five of their favourite things. The way it works is my guests always choose a favourite film, book, song, place, and possession. They tell me their choices in advance so I can research them, but they don't tell me why they've chosen them. That's the subject of our conversation. The reason I devised this series is I wanted to create a slightly different way to gain a genuine insight into the real lives and thoughts of prominent people. Lane Beachley is one of the most remarkable athletes Australia has ever produced. She's a genuine star on the global stage, winning no fewer than a record 7 World Surfing Championships. I first met Lane 4 years ago. We were in the ocean, but we didn't have surfboards. In fact, we didn't have swimmers either, as we were both doing the Sydney Skinny at the time. So Lane, I have to ask, what did you find more challenging, getting naked for the Sydney Skinny or choosing your items for the Five of My Life?
Seeing you naked, Nigel.
That was the most challenging thing.
But it's a great program, and it's a real liberating experience to get out of your own way and embrace the skin you're in and go and dive in the water and swim with hundreds of, if not thousands, of strangers.
Well, you're a dead set legend to have done it. So onto your choices. Did you find the process challenging or easy?
There were certain answers that I found incredibly easy, and then there was a couple of choices, such as the possession, for example.
Right. Don't tell us what it is yet, but you found that really hard.
I found that really challenging because I said to my husband, if this house was burning down, what would be the 3 main possessions you'd run out of here with? And he didn't actually pick me. He did pick his computer, his phone, and his passport. I'm like, no, they're not real valuable positions.
So this is great. So you were getting him to do it as well?
Well, just certain things.
Yeah,
certain aspects, just to give me some inspiration.
But, so what I found which is quite fun, is people say, I was thinking about mine, and then I end up talking to my mum or my girlfriend or my husband or whatever. And so,
Yeah.
So we're going to start with your film.
Now,
you've chosen the second Austin Powers film, The Spy That Shagged Me.
It's very shagadelic, baby.
The rumour is that they're going to make a fourth one, and it's called For Your Thighs Only. Isn't that great?
That's gold.
So before you tell us why you chose it, tell me what you like about the film or what you don't like about the film.
Why did I choose The Spy Who Shagged Me? Well, do I make you randy, baby? Do I? I love the humour. I love the characters. And one of my favourite characters in that film was Fat Bastard.
Yep.
And I happened to watch that film, I think, 7 times.
Wow.
To the point where I could recite the film from beginning to end. All the different characters, all the different lines.
Is it Heather Graham?
Yes.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, Felicity Shagwell.
Yeah.
Shagwell by name, Shag very well by reputation, baby.
And then there's someone in it with my maiden name. It's awful. My apologies. My maiden name was Spit. My married name is Swallow or something.
Yeah.
And then he does that look to camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah. Yeah, so there was a whole lot of hilarious moments in that film. And also why I chose it was because I think I actually, no, I was thinking that was the movie that I went on my second date with my husband, but it was the third Austin Powers film that I went on my second date.
Okay.
With my husband, my future husband, but now husband.
So this was 90.
This was 1999.
So you were on your second world.
Competing for my second world title, which happened to be my most challenging world title.
And why was that?
Well, as you'll see with a lot of athletes or teams who are attempting to repeat success, there seems to be this insurmountable amount of expectation and pressure on our shoulders. And no one's responsible more than ourselves for when we start to take that on. And I just took that on. As being, okay, now I'm number one in the world. All of a sudden, I have to be twice as good as what I was 6 months ago to repeat that success and deserve that success. I won 6 in a row and then had 2 years where I missed it because for a variety of reasons, 1, great competition, 2, severe injuries, and then came back and won my 7th one in 2006.
Bloody good on you.
I was 34 years old. competing against girls that weren't even born when I started touring.
Good
disrespectful little things they can do. Yeah.
What part of the world was the Second World Championship in?
Well, it's a points accumulation, so I was competing all over the world.
So you do, you add it up over... You can tell I know fuck all about surfing, don't you?
That's obvious. It's rather insulting, I can't believe. You know, you show me these notes and pretend you've been reading
all about surfing.
Not about my career, obviously. So let me fill you in.
Yeah.
I won my first world title in 1998, my second one, 99, third one, 2000, and on we went. I remember when that first Austin Powers film came out, I didn't quite get it.
Yep.
Because I was very serious, a very serious, focused, determined athlete.
Sure.
And had the compassion of a tiger shark for myself and others.
Yep.
And so when the second one came out, I got it. Mm. You know, I watched the first one a couple of times, went, okay, now I get it. It's actually just satire and it's supposed to be funny. And then when the second one came out, I just loved Fat Bastard and Dr. Evil and Mini-Me and just the way that Mike Myers creates these characters based on his own personal experiences with family
was
just hilarious. So I just loved it and fell in love with it. And that's why I had to watch it so often.
It's got a sensational soundtrack as well.
It does actually,
and it's got in it cameos from really brilliant musical. That's got Elvis Costello and Willie Nelson and Burt Bacharach.
The reason I chose this film was because it helped me win my second world title.
Tell me more.
Well, as I was saying, that insurmountable amount of pressure and expectation I was experiencing led to me pushing myself too hard. And that resulted in a severe knee injury right in the lead up to the US Open, which is about the fifth event of the year. And I had started to lose my sense of connection with the world title because I was having really inconsistent results, which is ultimately a result of inconsistent mindset and thought processes. And then what happened was I was in free surfing down at Trestles one afternoon and I did a maneuver that pushed me too far and I tore my medial ligament in my right knee. Mm. And so I was pretty much out for the next couple of events. I was supposed to stay out for 6 weeks. I stayed out for 10 days and then surfed in the US Open, didn't perform that well, but then went over to the UK.
Yep.
And which you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And I went and surfed at a place called Newquay.
Yes.
And
not Fistral Beach.
Fistral Beach and cold and small, standard. And so in between every heat, I would come in and put ice and a TENS machine on my knee and I'd have my foot elevated, did the whole rice thing, rest, ice, compression, elevation, and just managed to progress my way through heat after heat after heat. And I was surfing with a big carbon kind of knee brace on as well.
Right.
So it was a real challenging time, but at the time it was the richest event in the world, and it was offering $20,000 US prize money for first place, which is almost half of what I would earn in a year anyway.
Sure.
So I was going after it, and I also needed this result to propel me back into first place on the tour rankings so I could defend my world title.
Yes.
So I made the final, and I could see we had been at the beach since 7 o'clock that morning, and the final, due to summer and the sun being high, the final didn't surf till about 5 or 6, maybe even 7 o'clock that night. So we'd been at the beach all day. And I remember walking down to the final, I looked at my competitor and her eyes were bulging out of her head. She was exhausted, as was I. Mm-hmm. But I also got this hint that she had her eyes on the prize. She had her eyes on getting that money. And so I used the words of Fat Bastard to distract me from thinking about winning, to make sure that I stayed focused on the processes that I needed to follow to perform at my best, because when I perform at my best, I'm going to win.
Yeah.
And so I remember paddling around in the water, looking at her and just going, you can keep your money. I want your baby. I want my baby back, baby back, baby back, baby back. Ribs, chilies, baby back ribs. And so I just started reciting Fat Bastard to distract me from the fact that I'm competing for a final and a win and 20,000 US, but I want the win. I don't want the prize money.
Yeah.
And so it was just a really healthy distraction to keep me.
That's a sensational story.
I went on and won. And the thing was, in the UK, they actually had to go and raid all the banks to get the cash, to pay me in cash. And they paid me $3,000 in $1 bills. So I had this wad of cash that I ended up traveling through Europe with. I felt loaded.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, I had to just kind of money launder. Yeah. You know, I had to carry all this cash around with me for several months as I went around the tour. And then ultimately that win gave me the confidence to then change my direction a little bit, work on my equipment a little bit more. And then I ultimately won my second world title in Hawaii later that year.
And Mike Myers would have no idea.
No, of course not.
the impact is
had. Wouldn't have any idea.
20 years before that film, Michael End wrote The Neverending Story, German author, and you have chosen that as your book.
I have.
Did you read it then or later, or was it read to you? Or you read, okay.
I read it in the 80s, and it was my favourite book as a child. And similar to how the book is, I guess it's an escape from reality. It goes from fantasia to the real world, back to fantasia to the real world. And he didn't write it to educate or teach. He wrote it to take us in on a mystical journey into the magical world. Hmm. And, you know, the story around this little chubby kid who's just lost his mum and...
Bastion, is it?
Yep. Yeah, and being bullied by other kids, and runs into this antique bookshop and sees the guy on the phone and reading this amazing looking book, and is just so captivated by the cover of the book. He's like, I've got to have that book. And so the guy gets on the phone, he steals the book, and then that goes on to the rest of the story and how he becomes a hero.
Yes.
So I just thought it was a beautiful tale because it was, even though it wasn't there to educate, it did inspire. And it took me away. You know, I think as a kid we have such, most of us when we're children, well, I'm very fortunate as a child. I had the freedom to roam and the freedom to imagine, the freedom to create, and also the freedom to fail. And I feel that that's one of the things that's enabled me to become a successful adult, or all of those things, actually. Mm. So what I love about this book was just the freedom to imagine.
Sure.
And share in that story with all of those characters, and how he can, and we all do this as human beings, you know, we immerse ourselves in something and we become convinced that that's where we're meant to be, and then we doubt it, mm-hmm. and then we sabotage it, and then someone gives us some advice or wisdom, and then we re-believe it. And so then we immerse ourselves back in it.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden we become the hero of our own story. And that's essentially why the book inspired me.
How did you get the book?
That's a very good question. I think my dad might have bought it for me as a birthday present, or maybe I saw it when we were out at the shops one day and I said, Dad, I've got to have this book. Can I please have this book?
Yeah.
Can I have this book? And so I was very fortunate my dad bought me the book. And then when my brother, Jason, had his first son, Joshua, I gave it to him as his christening present because it was my favourite childhood book.
And do you reread it, or do you read it to his kids?
I do reread it.
Oh.
Yes, I do love it. It's because I read a lot, like you know, you've written a book, as have I, and I read a lot of professional development, self-development kind of style of books. It's nice to immerse yourself in magical lands and just forget about life for a little while and detach from your own reality to immerse yourself in someone else's. So I think it's a really healthy escape, that book.
There's a wonderful story about the writing process of it, where the author called up the publisher. So it was supposed to be published in 1977. And he called up and said, I can't get Bastion out of...
Fantasia.
So he's written him into it, and he goes, I can't get him out.
Really?
And he goes, well, that's just a book, mate. He goes, yeah, I know, but I'm the author and I'm in it, and I can't get him out.
So he Bastion?
Well, that's right. I mean,
yeah,
as
Michael
the author
must have been Bastion,
I just can't get him out. So the deadline was pushed back like 9-10 times because you get, you know, where's Bastion now? Yeah, well, he's still stuck there. And then eventually he got him out and published the book in 79.
There you go.
And I love the fact that he's called, his name is appropriate for a never ending story. He's called Michael End. But there
yes,
you go.
Yeah, I yeah. know, right?
Fantasy.
You owe him a dollar.
So that was made into three films, actually. And many people, when I was preparing for this, many people I was asking about Never Ending Story, they all referenced the film, not the book.
Really?
But your song that you've chosen is potentially best known from a film as well, from the wonderful 8 Mile.
Yes.
So you chose Lose Yourself.
I am Eminem.
Which won the Oscar for the best original song.
Yep, and what an awesome film.
Oh, yeah. And to end on the scene, holy, it's a bit like actually Purple Rain, where you know, it's at the end when the credits are going, but it sums it up so amazingly. Mm. And the story of Eminem, him writing that on the set.
Mm.
You know, but it's not about what I like about the song,
no.
It's about what you like about
the song. Take
you there. So tell me why you've what you like about it and why you've chosen it.
Well, I love the passion, the honesty, the rawness. It is a biographical. You know, creates biographical images when he sings it, and essentially it became my anthem to win my 6th and 7th world titles because I rarely listened to music before I competed, and just randomly when I was competing for my 6th consecutive world title, because I wanted to achieve something that no other athlete or surfer had ever done, male or female, so that's I was really working hard towards that. I just put my headphones in my ears and I pressed play on my iPod, and that was the first song that came on.
Right.
And so it became my anthem. And I thought, you know, I've got to lose myself in the music and the moment, and I own it. I better never let go because I only get one shot.
Yeah.
And I love at the start, he said, if you had the chance to capture everything you've ever wanted, would you just let it slip?
Hmm.
And I think there was times, well, I know there was times when I was competing that I did let it slip. And I was very fortunate that I was able to capture it and not let it slip.
Hmm.
Either someone within my dream team brought it to my attention or I brought it to my own attention. So long story short, when I was sitting in the water competing for my sixth world title in the quarterfinals, because this was several days later, I was thinking that it's over because I was being beaten, I was losing. I started to believe that, okay, my chances are done, so let's just get over it and, you know, I'll just come back next year. I was giving myself all these excuses and mm-hmm. reasons and stories, and it's all self-sabotage, you know, it's just yeah. all a story. And then I sat up and I went, no, I am going to win this. I'm going to get out of my own way. So I used all of the knowledge that I'd drawn upon to motivate myself to win this in the lead up to this particular event. It was the last event of the year on Maui at Honolulu Bay. And then so as I'm reinforcing this positivity in my own mind, all of a sudden I start tuning into the music that they're playing randomly over the loudspeaker, and Eminem came on.
Amazing.
So I'm sitting in there, sitting in the water, you better lose yourself in the music the moment you own it. And so then a wave popped up in front of me and it was my opportunity to go. Fortunately, my competitor who had priority missed it, and the first wave of the set this particular day was the best wave. I rode it to the best of my ability. I needed a 6.67. I scored an 8.5, and
wow.
that won me my sixth world title.
Wow.
So that song has inspired me
yeah.
to become the best of the best. And then once again, when I was competing several years later, 3 years later, for my seventh world title, just randomly put my headphones in, press play, and then it came on again.
It's incredible, the sort of the law of attraction and,
yeah.
and coincidences. And I can't think, I mean, hearing that wonderful story, of any more appropriate lyric for what you were going through and what you needed at that moment.
True.
It's just incredible.
Yeah.
Reading about you in preparation for this is you seem uncommonly sort of introspective and thoughtful about stuff. Is that something you've always been? Or you, I wrote down here when you said you're the compassion of a tiger shark. Whereas I've only known you recently, and you're very charming and likeable. And but so it seems, in a way, that you are a different person now than maybe you were whenever.
It's very observant of you.
Yeah.
Yes, I am. I'm a completely different person. Sometimes I reflect on the athlete that I was and can barely compare myself to that person. I can barely relate to that person. I was very fierce, very driven, very hungry, almost desperate. And it was also at a time when there was limited opportunity for female athletes, let alone
yes.
women surfers. So it was just fight and just, you know, may the strongest survive. Survival of the fittest and the strongest and the most determined. And I had this very negative belief that for me to win, I had to either hate my competition or behave in a way that gave them reason to hate me. And so
right.
that's what drove me.
Yeah.
And that's what cost me as well.
Sure.
It cost me my sense of happiness. It cost me my quality of relationships with my competitors and my peers.
Mm.
It cost me my health and well-being. I had so many severe injuries. I had chronic fatigue twice. I had near life-threatening injuries from random mistakes and experiences at very nasty waves. And it cost me my quality of joy as an athlete. You know, a lot of athletes, they reflect on their competitive years and go, they were the best years of my life. Or I reflect on those years and go, they were the hardest years of my life. Very few athletes have that mentality. And so I am very introspective. I'm very reflective.
Yeah.
And I want to learn and I want to grow and I want to improve and I want to enhance people's journeys through their lives to make sure they don't have to go through the same shit that I went through.
It's amazing hearing you talk, Lane. For me, there's something that happened in my career, actually, that really changed my life, where someone was chatting me through the difference between abundancy theory and paucity theory. So if you want to win, that there's one notion, which is, well, if I win, everyone else has got to lose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I move to Australia, I've got to say that I hate England. There's another version. So you're oppositional.
Mm-hmm.
There's another version, which is the cake's big enough for everyone. You can win. You can be, it's abundancy theory, is you can be world champion surfer and be nice to everyone and help everyone else as well, rather than, it's not, so if I'm running a company and I want it to be successful, that doesn't mean I've got to kill everyone else.
No.
You go, I'll be successful. And who knows, maybe my success will help other people as well get success.
Exactly.
You think, wow.
Yeah.
And what it does, it makes you more likable, genuinely, but also it means you're not living a life that's misaligned. So you know when you're being a dick, right? And if you're walking around going, well, I don't really like the person I am, that's not healthy for your soul.
But then there's so many times where if you're pursuing something of absolute necessity, and I mean, we could go into so many different layers in this one, but if you're going through something where you absolutely, like your identity, your sense of self-worth is wrapped around it, then I don't give a fuck what anyone thinks. I have to have that. And if you're not with me, get the fuck out of my way,
because
I'm going to eat you alive, because that is way more important to me than earning your recognition or respect or friendship. I don't care what you say. And that's how fierce that I was.
And there's something which sort of troubles me, because I look at the success that you have had, and in a very minor way in some other fields, the success that I've had makes it easier potentially for you and I to then become nicer people because you've scratched that itch.
Right.
So just pretend you tried as hard as you could to be a successful surfer and you came third in six world championships. So you never were the world champion.
Yeah.
Then it's an even bigger thing.
Yes.
And some of the people that you talk to who you inspire, let's be honest, they're not going to be world champions at anything.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a really, really noble endeavor to help people who aren't going to be the super achievers.
Mm.
So there's one thing, you could be incredibly useful to, you know, train a protege who wants to be a world surfing champion, obviously, but it's the other work you do that I think is more noble, because not everyone is going to be
a
world surfer.
And that's the work that I more enjoy.
Yeah.
But just going back to your point around the two different theories, around scarcity and then having abundance, if you have this fundamental belief that success has to be hard, and it's a subconscious belief, then you will make it so.
Yes.
And you can't change what you can't see. So sometimes you need to bring these things to the surface.
Yeah.
And that just means taking a stock take, like stopping and asking yourself, am I happy with the person I am and with the gravitational pull or push that I have?
Yeah.
You know, have I got the right people around me? You know, sometimes you just got to ask yourself, am I producing the results that I want?
Yeah.
If not, what's stopping me? And I had this fundamental belief that success had to be hard, and that came from a lot from my experiences as a child.
Yep.
And, you know, I've got plenty of explanations, but that doesn't mean I have to live by that.
No.
I can choose to change it. So now, after winning six consecutive world titles in a state of fear and a seventh world title in a state of love,
yes,
I know that you can succeed in two different
ways.
Yeah, yeah. You and I both have the luxury of having had success before changing our perspectives on that. The thing is that it's still easy for me to just fall back into what I refer to as my survival mode.
Right.
Which is the six world titles, 1-6.
Yeah.
That's survival mode.
Yeah.
That's when it's fear. That's when it's striving, struggling, holding on, clawing in, trying, guessing, hoping, thinking. It's hard just saying those words.
Yeah.
When I need to break out of that, which is very quickly, because it's not sustainable. You've got to look at how you're going about achieving success, and if it's not sustainable, then you have to change it.
Yeah.
And I know that I can win in a state of love. My seventh world title proved that to me.
Sure.
If I can't seek evidence of that in my own life, then I seek evidence of that in someone else.
Yeah.
And my number one inspiration in that state is Stephanie Gilmore.
Right.
Because she is very successful and does take people along on the ride.
Yeah, wonderful.
Right? She makes success look easy. Even though I know it's not, but she makes it look like fun. She exudes joy when she paddles into waves. She's paddling around with this state of gratitude. She's just really enjoyable to watch. And I'm like, so she proves to me that success can be,
it
can be achieved in a state of grace and effortlessness.
This is The Five of My Life. More with Lane after the break. This is The Five of My Life with Nigel Marsh. It's a real privilege to hear you talk like this. So there's something else I got quite powerfully from you that I found surprising in reading your book and researching you is, and forgive me for saying this, but it appears that you are susceptible to sort of like crippling self-doubt when all the evidence would be pointing to the reverse. So it's one thing if you go, well, actually, I'm an alcoholic, my life is a disaster, I've never done anything, and I've never had a job, la, 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 la. You go, okay, you might think, I think we're all God's children and everyone's worthwhile, but you might think with that data set, I'm not very worthy. You go, well, I'm the world champion, for fuck's sake. I've done it 7 times, whoopity-what. And yet you still seem to get hit with the black cloud of, I'm not very worthy.
Yeah, I'm not enough.
And that stop it.
Right, I commit to that right now, that I am enough. Yeah. And I can walk into, you know, quite honestly, if I'm ever having a self-pity party for one, I just walk into my trophy room, have a look around and go, yeah, I've done all right.
Yeah.
I've got nothing to complain about.
But do you, is that true? You do?
You know what? I only go into those moments where I'm fatigued.
Right. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, if I've worn myself out, then I start to doubt.
Yeah.
So then I have to question, well, have I pushed too hard or am I really believing this?
Yeah.
And then I just have to look in my own eyes in the mirror and look at the colour of them and go, okay, yeah, I'm exhausted.
Right.
You need to take a day off or you just need to lighten up, stop weighing in with commentary that's not serving you.
Yeah.
Create a whole new mantra, set a new set of beliefs and lighten up on yourself. Have some fun.
Get out your own way, as you said
earlier.
Yeah,
get out of my own way and go surfing.
So we have to get on. This is the five of my life. We have to get on to your fourth choice. Now, most people, when I ask them to choose a place, choose a specific geographical place, but you've gone next level. You've gone the ocean.
Yes.
So tell me about that.
The ocean is my place of solace. It's the one place in the whole universe where I feel a sense of freedom. I feel truly relaxed, and the most burning desire in every human being, I feel a sense of belonging. I don't feel like I belong anywhere else other than in the ocean.
And is it equally good whether it's Fistral Beach or Manly Beach? As long as it's salt. Okay, interesting. How wonderful, because there is a lot of it on this planet.
I'm very fortunate.
You can access it.
And it's warming up.
Yeah. And so have you ever lived away from it?
No, I have not, ever. If anything, I've just committed my life to living as close to it as I possibly can. And one of the best pieces of advice I received when I started earning decent money was invest in real estate that you could ultimately live in yourself. Mm-hmm. So every piece of real estate I ever bought had ocean views.
Right, okay.
And then I went to London for the Olympic Games in 2012 as an athlete liaison officer for the Australian Olympic team.
Yeah.
And spent 6 or 7 weeks around London, and I immersed myself into the Olympic Games. I had an access hilarious pass, as if I'm not going to abuse the hell out of that.
Yeah.
So I did. And I had an absolute ball, but once again, immersing myself and giving too much of myself, I left there completely exhausted. My sister was working in London at the time, so I grabbed her and she and I went to Barcelona for a holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute I got there, I dove in the ocean and I cried because I didn't realize how much I'd missed.
You'd missed it, right?
Feeling like I'm nurtured.
Sure.
I feel like I go back into the womb.
Right.
Like it's my embryonic fluid when I'm in the ocean. I feel that sense of joy and freedom and happiness and centeredness and connectedness and just, that's how I feel every time I'm in the water.
Do you fear for it?
Do I fear for it?
Fear for the ocean.
I do fear for the ocean. Well, I fear for our lives because we will not survive without the survival of our oceans and our coral. You know, that produces our oxygen. It's the plankton that produces our oxygen. So, yeah, I fear for the ocean.
I saw a film recently, which I wish I hadn't, and it was about plastic in the ocean.
Which one was that?
I forget what it's called. It's a documentary. And the thing that stuck with me, which I can't get it out of my head, is my amateur thinking is, okay, there's all this crap in the ocean where we can scoop it out one day, right?
One day.
What the film showed was that the plastic breaks down into micro beads, so it's like a soupy mess, which you can't. So it's not like I think, oh, okay, well, I'll go and pick the plastic bag up. No. It's broken down. It will be there for 600 years.
At least.
And you go, oh, my word.
Yeah, we're suffocating our planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, just through plastic. My own dentist didn't realise there was microplastics in toothpaste.
Right.
He's like, why do you use herbal toothpaste? Like, because there's no microplastics in them. He's like, what's a microplastic? Oh, God, here we go.
So I've got a confession for you. So I do something. My children laugh at me. I actually make them do it as well, so they avoid me. It's a thing called take three.
I'll take three for the sea. I do it every day.
I love it. Oh,
it's
good
so
on
easy.
You. And you know, I get a real. And if I. If
Why
I've
do
only,
your children laugh at you?
Well, because dad's a saddo. So even if I can only get two, I go looking for the third. I go, where are you going? I go, hold on, I haven't got my third bit of plastic.
The unfortunate thing is that when you're walking along the beaches on the northern beaches, that it's not that hard to find three. I actually commit myself to finding a dozen. I literally commit myself to picking up everything I walk past, because what you walk past, you allow. You set the standards by your own behaviours.
Do you know Little Marley Beach in the national park?
Mm.
So I went, it's a beautiful place, and I was really upset. It's the most beautiful place. You've got to walk there.
Yeah.
And then there's all this shit on the beach.
Yeah, it's distressing.
I wish I'd brought a bin liner.
Yeah.
So I'm putting other people's...
In your plastic.
Yeah.
So when I find plastic in the water and I'm in a bikini, I can't hold it. So I paddle up to a mate with broad shorts and ask him if he's got a pocket. And just
But here we go. I'm a long-range optimist.
Yes,
we're going to sort this shit out.
We're
going to sort it out somehow.
But you know what? It's not just the plastic that we've got a concern with. It's all of our behaviours. And we're too apathetic. We're just waiting for someone else to do it because we don't think we can make any difference. But every one of us can make a difference by just choosing to not buy single-use plastics, reject the use of straws. The number one culprit for marine and beach pollution in when it regards to plastic are those little sushi fish caps, those little red caps. I pick up one every single day. And just making different choices and thinking ahead. And that's all it takes. And people think it has to change the world to be important. But actually, just by changing your thought patterns and changing your choices changes the world. And then it does make it important.
I'm so glad you do. I'm going to no longer feel embarrassed about it. I'm going to proudly do
Tell
take three.
Tell your kids, Lane does it. And if they don't,
that's
then
it. Okay,
I'm going to come around and belt them.
On to your last choice.
Yes.
Now, your last choice has little or any monetary value, but I imagine enormous emotional value.
Yeah.
You've chosen your personal diary from 2002 and 2003.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So I was looking through my trophy room wondering what possession do I treasure the most? Now, I've got my baby bracelet and I've got world title trophies and I've got gold medals from Masters Games and I've got actually one of the most amazing plaques I have is a photo of me with autographs of congratulations from all of the world champions before me congratulating me. I thought, well, that's pretty cool. I better take that off the wall if anything happens here. But I started looking through all the different books that I had and I found my diary and I started reading through it and I went, oh, wow, there's some pretty monumental entries in this diary. Just from the moment that I met Kirk, when I was set up with Kirk.
Is that in 2002?
2002.
Sure.
Actually, the diary starts even before that when I broke up with my previous partner, Ken, and I was with him for 5 years and we broke up in 2002 and I met Kirk quite soon after that and I was set up by John Stevens from Noiseworks and frontman of NXS. And then so just the entries that I have about how much I love him and how much I'm grateful for having him in my life.
Yeah.
And just the thoughts of marriage and things like that in the first 3 or 4 months. And I had never experienced that level of commitment or unconditional love in my life. And so when I read it, I was even astonished at the absolute love that I had for him for such a quick in such a quick space of time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it fascinated me. And then I went on to win my 5th world title and what that meant to me.
Yeah.
And then in 2003, just the changes. And I actually declared my love for Kirk on national television on the Andrew Denton show.
Ballsy move.
Very ballsy.
And had you agreed you were going to do that or you just went, oh, my God, she's gone, Troppo.
The girl's lost it. My competitors probably thought, oh, good, Lane's weak.
Yeah.
But it strengthened my resolve.
Yeah.
And it's some of the challenges that I endured throughout that year and then losing my mojo and going back into a really depressed state and then how I was able to overcome that and some of the conversations that I've had with people and some of the really dark, distressing thoughts that I had that I wrote in my journal and then some of the thoughts that actually lifted me up and got me out of that space. So it's a really beautiful reflection of some of the things that I went through, some of the challenges that I overcame because, you know, I talk about the fact that, you know, we all we achieve something and no one sees the shit that we go through. Mm. A lot of us actually just put that out of our own minds. We don't even recognize the shit we go through. So, yeah, it was a really valuable little item that I found. I went, wow, this is awesome.
And you've been keeping a diary since you were 12, is that right? And do you...
Actually, maybe even younger.
Do you keep them all?
Yeah, I've kept them all.
And do you ever reread them?
Yes, when I write my book.
Do you find yourself squeezing your buttocks in embarrassment or do you...
Well, only when I read some of the... things that I've written in there, knowing that my author had read them.
Right.
Yeah. I freely handed my diary to him thinking,
this is Michael.
Yeah, Michael Gordon, who I'm so deeply just disappointed that we've lost him too early.
Hmm.
But I was so grateful that I had the opportunity to write my book with Michael Gordon. Hmm. And I freely handed over my diaries and went, here you go. Yeah. And then I'm reading about some of the even sexual encounters.
I just
read that and went, oh my God, how did Michael look me in the face the next day after reading that stuff?
Sure.
Just some of that kind of thing. But yes, I've been keeping diaries and I remember I used to write in calendars. I was a massive fan of Garfield as a kid.
Right.
I had lots of Garfield calendars and I remember just squeezing as much as I could into a square to write about my day. And a lot of it was unreal and stuff. And I remember my nan, I called her my nan, but she was like our nanny who came and looked after me after my mum died when I was six. And she obviously had start reading them because she'd leave post-it notes saying, stop writing unreal. I'm like, why are you reading my diary?
Wow. Yeah. Well, listen, so you're an angel to come in and talk so authentically and unguardedly. I'm really grateful. The last trick question is, who do you want to listen to next on Five of My Life? We've got an amazing contact list here. They can't be dead and they can't be fictional. Okay. So who would you like me to call next to get on the show?
What about Pink?
Consider it done. Brilliant.
She's got the time. Five of My Life with Nigel Marsh. Bring it on.
I love it. Lane Beachley, thank you so much for being on Five of My Life.
Thanks for having me.
The Five of My Life was presented by me, Nigel Marsh, created in collaboration with Podcast One Australia. Producer, Alex Mitchell. Sound production and theme music by Darcy Thompson and Matt Nicolish. For more episodes, go to podcastone.com.au, download the Podcast One app, or search The Five of My Life on Apple Podcasts.